good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 8th of August. And it's already the 8th of August. Last week we were saying, oh, it's the beginning of the month, and now we're already the 8th day in, and then summer's over, and then, you know, ..
And then we're almost to 2026.
That's right. Exactly, Aaron. We have a great show for you today. And so I screwed up the billboard because it was sort of a late addition. But initially, we were going to take, first of all, people have been asking about the panel. We've been going a little bit longer in the panel over the last couple of days because Ian Pickus leaving us last week. He was the person in charge of the Congressional Corner. So while we work to get a new Congressional Corner person in place and operating, we are not going to be doing Congressional Corner. I mean, we will be, but just not yet. We're working up to it. So in that time, we'll be extending those panels. And so I've just been saying we'll take it to the top of the hour in the 2 o'clock. Now, last night, our friends from Tanglewood called and said, hey, would you like to talk to Keith Lockhart? He's got his 30th anniversary coming up, and he's doing film night at Tanglewood tomorrow night for John Williams. Would you like to do that? And I said, yes. Yes. So we're going to have do the panel till and this is the first time the panelists know this. We're going to be doing the panel until 10:50. And then we're going to go to our interview with Keith Lockhart. And then at 11 o'clock, and this is the stuff I didn't get to tell you about, but we're going to talk to the actress who is playing Joan Rivers in a new show called Joan, which is at the Barrington Stage Company. We're very excited about that. And then we're going to be talking to a man by the name of Samson Knight, who is a writer and a Truman Capote Fellow. His new novel is Likeness. It is about open marriages. And we'll talk to him coming up in our 11 o'clock hour. So a lot going on. We'll get to it. And we'll certainly get to this panel right now. Let me introduce our panelists to you. Judith Ankus here, former EPA regional administrator, professional. She is professional. She's very professional. Professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
I'm terrific. When I'm not watching the news, I am terrific. Good morning, everyone.
How about when you're talking about it?
So-so.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll make the best of it. Santa College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I find it, to piggyback on what Judith said, it's much easier to be a producer of news and analysis than a consumer of news and analysis at this point in time. So I'm thrilled to be here.
I have to say, I was last week, Aaron was with us, and we were talking about the jobs report. And then as I was driving home, the president up and fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is what we had been talking about all morning, not the firing, but about the numbers themselves. And when I go home, I go right by Aaron's house, and I was ready to stop in, pull in the driveway, and just continue the show.
Right.
Because I felt like we had left stuff on the table.
Do you want to hear an interesting little bit of trivia about that?
Yes.
So the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is a extremely technical, nonpartisan job. This is not politics at all. It's making sure that the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau administer their surveys correctly. They look at the data correctly. It's processed in a timely manner. The commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who was fired, Erica McIntarfer, when my wife and I lived in Washington, D.C., she was our next-door neighbor in an apartment building, and it was very clear she was aspirational. So I've known her since 2003, not in a professional context, but it was just one of those things where it's just like, wow, you could not pick somebody who was more qualified and less partisan to oust.
She called you for a job yet?
No, she hasn't. I'm sure she'll be fine with her background. But when I saw that, I was like, Yeah, we were her neighbors. We walked her dogs.
World.
Yeah,
oh, you know. That's cool. Well,
and on the show last week, you never could have predicted that she was going to be fired.
No, I mean, right? I guess like I don't think it's anyone really? Who saw the story thought. I mean, when you heard the story, you were like, oh, well, that's Trump. But I don't think when we were talking about it, we thought that would be the immediate outcome. But there you go.
Here we are.
Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society. She's right there. Boom, right in front of me. Of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel is here. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks so much. My birthday's next week. So,
congratulations.
Leo, I celebrate all month.
Oh, good.
Fellow Leos would know that.
What day specifically is your birthday?
The 13th.
Oh, very nice.
Which
Wednesday.
Is the same birthday as my puppy. We have the same birthday.
Oh.
Yes.
And how old is the puppy?
She's turning 2.
Oh, that's exciting. What kind of dog?
She's a German Shepherd mix.
Oh, I love Shepherds.
Yeah,
oh,
she's great.
So you're throwing a rager?
I am.
For both of you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've planned several ragers.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
then, like, right now I'm like, does she get the ice cream cake that I get?
Yeah.
What dog version? Maybe.
It sounds fun. We welcome you all to the program panel at WAMC.org. Welcome to our Radio Rager. We're about to begin. WAMC, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Okay, so this has been a story that's been in the news all week, and there's nothing we can do about it. So here we begin to talk about it. Which is led by Trump, Republicans push to redraw election maps in new states. This, according to the Washington Post. This all comes out of the story, of course, in Texas. At least that's where it began. Republicans are exploring ways to redraw congressional maps in their favor well beyond Texas, as President Donald Trump pushes for aggressive changes, worrying that some in his party who have little appetite for an escalating redistricting war with Democrats. The White House has been driving the GOP redistricting effort, according to people familiar with the process, some of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity. Republicans are discussing ways to create new red seats in Missouri and Indiana and Ohio ahead of next year's midterm elections and carve out as many as 5 in the state of Florida, even as they face legal hurdles. A White House spokesman said that staffers have not drawn any maps. John McLaughlin, one of Trump's pollsters, said the president doesn't want to risk facing Democratic-led investigations, as he previously did, if the party retakes control of Congress. After everything he's been through, I don't think he wants to leave anything to chance that would allow his opponents to do what they did to him in the first term and in the subsequent years. Some elected Republicans are skeptical of the push to redraw, concerned about Democratic retaliation in blue states, and hesitant to shake up longstanding lines. In GOP-controlled Indiana, where Vice President J.D. Vance met Thursday with state leaders and discussed redistricting, many Republican state lawmakers are unenthusiastic about the idea, according to a GOP legislator who spoke without giving his name so he could describe these private conversations. And is that what? And then he went to Ohio and raised the river? Is
I think he raised the river before he went to Ohio.
Okay. he wanted to take a boat ride. Mm-hmm. The river was a little low, so
yeah.
they dammed it up, and they raised the river and so he could get a better view.
What's the point of being the vice president if you can't just make rivers flow when you want?
I don't know.
It's like
the
opposite of parting the seas.
Well, right. And if you raise it higher, it's more visible when Trump just walks across the water.
Yeah, I think these guys are just so arrogant. They don't think anyone at the Army
right.
Corps of Engineers is ever going to share this information, and they're just going to set themselves up for future problems.
Well, let's begin with you, Judith Inc., regarding the redistricting and what it looks like in Texas and beyond.
Well, this may seem like a dorky inside baseball good government debate. It is so serious because I think it's part of a three-prong effort by the Trump administration to do everything possible, both legal and illegal, to make sure that they hold the House in the midterms. So first, we see the redistricting, and we'll get into that. Second, they're going to push for redoing the census earlier than usual, and they're going to be working overtime to make sure that where there's a cluster of Democratic voters, that they don't let people register for the census. And then third, they're going to go after and have been going after voting rights. So, you know, one at a time, the redistricting, look, it is a mess even without the influence of King Trump. In New York, you know, it's they have an independent redistricting commission, but you have districts that, you know, look very oddly shaped. The Democrats are always looking for an advantage, as are the Republicans.
You go in, you take the either the silly putty or the Play-Doh, and you take it out of the color is your choice. Take it out of the container, you put it in your hand, and then you just squeeze. And as it oozes out, and then you put it down, you say, oh, that's our district.
That's one way to describe it. But there's.
I mean, that's what they look like.
Yeah, because they're looking to have political party advantage.
Right.
And redistricting is a problem. Full stop. Now, what they're trying to do in Texas.
And both parties.
Yes,
do it.
Both. Absolutely.
Yes.
And that's why you have good government groups saying we really need to do an independent redistricting process based on math, based on making sure there's enough minority representation. This has been a problem for years, but this is now a problem on steroids. And it's starting in Texas, where Trump has contacted Governor Greg Abbott and said he is nervous about the Democrats picking up more seats. So change the districts, you know, like eliminate Jasmine Crockett's district entirely. And what I find really interesting is we think of Texas as primarily a Republican bastion. It wasn't long ago that Ann Richards was the governor of Texas.
Well, 94?
Yeah. So it was long ago.
Yeah.
But I looked up the numbers. In terms of enrollment of registered voters, there are more Democrats than Republicans in Texas. Dems are 46.5%. Republicans are 40%. And unaffiliated, 15.5%. So I've always had the perception that, you know, the Republicans were in total control in Texas. In fact, there are far more registered Democrats than Republicans. So they are trying to redistrict in the middle of all of this. As you know, the Democrats have fled the state. This is not the first time they've done this. Ironically, the special session, which lasts 30 days, was called to deal with the horrible aftermath of the flooding in Texas. And then Governor Abbott is trying to sneak in redistricting. So I think the Democrats that are in the Democratic legislature, the Democratic minority in the legislature, have done the right thing. They fled the state. Now there's talk of the FBI pursuing them. And remember, who's the head of the FBI? Cash Patel. Not exactly a model of good government. I don't think these legislators have done anything criminal, but yet they're trying to intimidate them by having the FBI go after them. And there are 54 of these state legislators that have left their families. Some of them are doing constant media, so it's not like they're in hiding. And, you know, if the FBI tries to find them in Illinois, like outside of a TV studio, it won't be hard to find them. I think these legislators seem very determined not to facilitate this, and they can head to Mexico or Canada.
There you go, Aaron Bassetti.
It's clear at this point that the Trump administration is going to pursue a nothing is off limits, nothing is out of bounds, we're going to break every norm that existed before to preserve power. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is a personality and psychological issue of this is a person who just wants to dominate and instill fear upon anyone who is not with him. The second one, which I think is more important to the rest of the population, is that he's imposing a lot of policies that are affecting a lot of people in a lot of different ways, and they are wildly unpopular, whether it's the tariffs raising the cost of a household budget by $3,000 a year, whether it's cutting Medicaid, whether it's making Social Security benefits harder to get, that when you impose these unpopular policies, you're going to have some angry voters, perhaps some from your own party. So a normal, sane, rational politician would say, well, maybe it's the policies that are the problem, and we should figure out how to change them to attract more voters. This is not what's happening. These are policies that almost exclusively benefit the richest 1% of the population, and you can't win an election with 1% of the vote. So what you do is you just redraw the maps to enhance your power. So you don't change the policies that are causing the problem. You change the maps so that you can get more representation in otherwise competitive districts. The easiest way to think about redrawing these maps really turns the whole concept of democracy on its head, where instead of letting voters choose their leaders, we have leaders choosing who their voters are. And this creates an enormous existential problem to how democracy functions. So in terms of a democratic strategy, you can't bring a knife to a gunfight. I know this is wildly unpopular, but if Republicans are going to do it, then I think Democrats need to engage in the same tactics wherever available, so that when 2026 rolls around, they at least have a fighting chance of reclaiming the House.
Nick Rangel.
Ooh, man. I hate to say it, but this has been the path of the conservative right-leaning camp for a very long time. They've been intentionally dismantling the Voting Rights Act that required a formula approach in Section 5 that would require the courts to review the racial impact of voting, of changes to election laws and practices. That legislation, along with other legislation, requires an evaluation of majority-minority districts, voting districts, to allow the consolidation of voting blocks, and has been the subject of litigation for a long time. And you know, the right has tried to dismantle that. They have had several significant wins at the Supreme Court, striking down those various provisions or certain provisions in the Voting Rights Act over the last, like, 10 or 15 years. And I think this is just the next step of what that looks like. If there is no oversight of redistricting maps and there is no accountability for how maps watered down the strength of voting blocks, not just Democrat and Republican, but voting blocks around racial lines, particularly in states that have long histories of Jim Crow laws and discrimination in voting rights, you see this tendency to claim that it's about Democrat votes, but in reality is truly about diminishing the voting power of BIPOC voters. And in Texas, as we were just talking about, where there are there is a high rate of Democratic voters, Hispanic voters are shifting to the right, particularly in states like Texas. And these redistricting maps would also diminish their voting power, even though they are voting and increasingly voting Republican, because it's not just about Republican Democrat. It's also about racial majorities having a voice in their local elections. And I think we have to keep that lens as an overlay that, you know, the racial inequality is ultimately kind of the premise behind whether the majority is a Republican or Democratic Party.
When you think of what we're going through in the redistricting in the states, and as the Democrats get involved in this too, and how far they want to go. It does seem like this has been a kerfuffle this week, but we are running out of time. And TikTok, I mean, even in New York, the time's passed, right?
Oh, yeah. In New York, you'd have to do a constitutional amendment. Which lost
last time.
Yeah. So it has to pass the legislature, I think, two consecutive sessions.
Yeah.
You would know, Nick, and then go to the voters. And so what Governor Hochul is proposing would not affect the midterms.
Yeah, I think her timeline at the earliest could put redistricting at 2027 as opposed to 2030, which is still a little earlier than the 10-year census cycle, but not by much.
I think what Governor Hochul is doing on redistricting is mostly performative because it's not going to affect the midterms, but she stakes out a position of, you know, standing up to Greg Abbott. I think some of the other Democratic states probably have a more likelihood of affecting the midterms. And this is really calling into question Michelle Obama's direction to when they go low, we go high, which I never subscribe to. But this is really a moment where are you standing up for the integrity of an independent redistricting process, or are you being politically realistic? And if Texas is going to, you know, throw the rules out and just draw lines that favor Republican districts, why wouldn't Democratic governors and Democratic state legislatures do the same thing to benefit Democrats? And the stakes could not be higher. I mean, I think what we're seeing this because Trump is way down in the polls. Now, theoretically, he's not running again, but he does not want Democrats controlling the majority in either House or governor's races. And this is a pickle, and it also distracts from Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, it distracts from a million things, right? The tariffs that are increasing costs and extracting wealth from average Americans while the wealthiest people are getting these tremendous tax cuts. And I mean, there's so many.
Yeah.
There's so many like bigger things.
Everything.
What's interesting is if the Republicans are successful in gaining more House seats, redistricting at the state and legislative level is not the only recourse that voters have, right? The Democratic turnout in Texas in the last election was shockingly bad. I mean, just really abysmal. It had been one of the lowest Democratic turnouts in Texas in years. They did not come out to vote. So if I am a Texas resident and I am a voter and I am looking at the continued diminishing of my voter, the weight of my vote, right? Like the value of my vote. I'm doing something. I'm protesting. I'm writing to electeds. I'm getting people to change their voter registration. I'm engaging. We're not seeing that, which I find terrifying. It does really feel like the analogy, the frog in the boiling water. Like, why are voters not more angry and more upset that they are losing their voice through this administrative practice, this like legislative, you know, back and forth? Like, it doesn't matter that Governor Hochul can't change the district maps in New York State until 2027 if Texas voters are just going to cede their rights before that, right? The other piece, I guess, is that the most significant aspects of the reconciliation bill won't take effect until after the midterms. And I think as the midterms come closer, I think people should and hopefully will become more outraged by the impact that that bill is going to have on them. And in the fall this year, assuming that the House can pass anything, we're likely to see massive cuts in other programs like my program, legal services, victim services, human services across the board. But the protests are not happening at the rate and the size and the the majority that they need to for there to be right for there to be like a response by lawmakers. Like, they're out there yelling, they're only yelling, but like, what are we doing? Like, what are we doing, broadly speaking?
Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
I think to your point, Nick, I think that a lot of the protests are probably going to mobilize people who aren't going to be voting for Trump or Republicans, period. I think what, Trump's got his base. Democrats have their base. That's not going to change. It's that, pretty thin middle. A lot of the budget bill, a lot of the tax cuts, the Medicaid cuts, all of those cuts won't go into effect until after the 26 midterms. But the silver lining to this, in my opinion, is that Republicans are a little leery about how they wouldn't be pursuing these strategies if they did not think that a House majority was up for grabs.
Right.
So the tariffs, I think, are going to be the things that are going to hit. That's going to hit consumer it'll hit consumer bank accounts. It'll hit consumer finances. It'll hit business. It'll hit, business finances. That's what's going to probably be the first wave that crashes and make people say, oh, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. And that's going to be a lot tougher, whether you cook the books and fire the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics so that unemployment job growth numbers look better and inflation seems lower. You can cook the books all you want. But people are going to feel that when they go to the grocery store, when they do back to school shopping for their kids, when they need to buy new clothes, when they need to buy a new or even a used car at this point. So I think the tariffs are going to be the bite that people feel first. So even though they might not be out in the street protesting, once that hits, I think that you will probably start to see an increase in the shift that Judith mentioned, which is Trump's approval ratings are going down. Consumer sentiment, there was a rebound last year, but it's still abysmally low. So I think once these economic effects start hitting people's finances, then you're going to see those trends intensify.
Yeah, and to support that, I read yesterday from a credible poll that 14% of voters who voted for Trump in the presidential election said they regret their vote and they would not have voted for Trump again. 14% is a lot because Trump has had this iron grip on Republican voters. So I think it's trending in the right direction, which is why we see all of this dramatic movement on redistricting, on census, and further erosion of voting rights. They're terrified that the House, at least, may go Democrat next year.
Well, the one thing that may be visible as we get closer to the midterms that is pretty common in midterm elections is that the party who is in power has a lower turnout rate typically, and the party that is the most, frustrated by the lack of power has a higher turnout rate. I mean, ultimately, like, the Democrats did not show up to vote in this last election, and they just had a pretty low turnout rate across the country. And if they did show up in mass at the midterms, I do think there are still like marginal seats that they could take over, especially in New York.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue in this conversation. We'll welcome your letters as well. panel@wamc.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we've got a lot going on. I have to say, I mentioned this yesterday, and I think it's to bolster or contextualize what Judith was saying earlier about this issue of it not being, you know, it's nerdy and it's not the most, you know, sexiest issue. But we've gotten more mail on this than any issue that we've talked about in the last, you know, 3 months, I would say.
Great.
And I find that really interesting of how involved people are. And the views are all over the place, too, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Well, so it's hard for, I mean, like, it's hard not to do what the Republicans are doing. But at the same time, you want integrity in the redistricting process, even if the Texas Republicans are doing what they're doing.
So with that in mind, we go to some of the letters that we have received. This from Fred. Face it, there is no longer a democracy. It's long past time for the Democrats to take the gloves off. It is no longer about saving democracy. It is about saving morality by any means.
That's the Aaron Pacetti camp.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, if you can go back to Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution in the 90s.
You are Mr. Morality.
To see the roots of the, we're going to take the gloves off. And Republicans have been taking the gloves off consistently, whether it's with government shutdowns, whether it's threatening to not raise the debt limit, whether it's lying about WMDs to go into Iraq. The gloves have been off for 30
decades.
Years.
Right.
And they've played the long game.
Yeah.
And they won.
Yeah.
So if Democrats, so to the letter writer's point, yeah, democracy was long gone. What we have is some type of, consensual
an
authoritarianism.
Oligarchy.
An oligarchy. But yeah, no, to Judith's point, it's Democrats can't play the game they've been playing for the past 30 years and expect to succeed. So there needs to be a new strategy, even if it involves playing dirty.
We go from Fred to Kate. Kate writes to us and says, voters are not, quote, not upset that they're losing their voice because they've already... Take two on reading this letter.
Here, let me read for you.
Okay, thank you. There's some extra
quadruple negatives or something.
Yeah, no, there's quotations and stuff. Anyway, voters are not upset that they're losing their voice because they already were upset. They already believe it has happened, and they're right. They are not surprised and not hopeful. I suppose I speak for myself only, but I believe that to be a widespread perception and more ubiquitous among blue collar and working poor.
Bad sentence structure, but we got it.
And yes.
Sorry, Kate. And it's a very good point.
Yes, it is a good point. Very good. All right. Let's go to Guy, who says, recent polls show that the Democratic Party is viewed more poorly by Democrats than it has been in a very long time. The party's platform and the Biden issue is the reason for these poll results and for swing voters going for Trump in the last election. Rather than just protest Trump, Democrats should also be showing us what they are changing in their platform to appeal to more people. This seems to be a very smart letter to me because it seems like there's many Democrats who are just waiting around for them to do something, anything.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, and let's look at what's going on in New York City. So Zohran Mamdani won the Democratic primary fair and square.
Right.
Record turnout. And so many more voters registered and voted. Record number of young people voting. So, you know, whether you agree with most of his stuff or not, he created a model on how to get people excited about voting. So what's the response from Chuck Schumer, from Kirsten Gillibrand, from Hakeem Jeffries, and Governor Hochul? The response is they don't endorse and support the winner of the Democratic primary in the largest city in the state. So I think this illustrates how out of touch mainstream Democratic Party people are. They're very poll driven. They're worried that they'll be associated with a Democratic socialist. But come on, people, the primary was in June, and you have them, and they're almost like Schumer, Gillibrand, Hochul, Jeffries not endorsing him is actually almost irrelevant. It's not going to affect the outcome of the vote.
No, but it is meaningful.
Yes.
And then, you know, you had Cuomo out of the race, and then Cuomo comes back in the race, and now Trump is saying, oh, well, you know, let's look at this and see if I can get involved.
Yeah.
It's a mess. But then you add to this the fact that, as we learned over the last week, that Schumer and Jeffries haven't even met with the president.
What this means is we're going to have a government shutdown. But, you know, all politics is local. And here in New York, we have an example of a good new different approach to engaging voters, and the response from the Democratic Party is quite irresponsible.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not saying that they are responsible for the reason of why they're not meeting with the president, but by the same token, why are they not making a huge deal about the fact mm-hmm. that they're not meeting with the president?
I think one reason for that is a lot of establishment Democrats are in the pockets of mega donors just as much mm-hmm. as Republicans are. Mm-hmm. They want to preserve their position. They want to be, you know, lifetime politicians. And they're not concerned about what voters want in terms of some very important core issues. Maybe some social issues, but they don't want to fundamentally change the economic structure, right? They don't want to raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires, who are the people contributing to get them elected to fund affordable housing. They don't want to raise taxes to fund Medicare for all. It's very clear, and it was blindingly clear in 2016, and it's just as clear today, that the country has been begging for a populist candidate to address a lot of the economic and social problems that have resulted from rising inequality for the past 45 years, whether it's stagnant wage growth, whether it's the rising cost of higher education, whether it's the rising cost of housing. Choose your issue. The reason Bernie Sanders went from, not a national name in 2016 to somebody who could go toe-to-toe with Trump tells you a lot about what Democrats think. And sadly, Hillary did not echo a lot of those points, and Trump was able to tap that vein to his advantage, and he's done it again. And here you see Democrats going back to what they did in 2016 and before, which is, yeah, we're not going to get behind people that Democrats that actually have a populist agenda, because it might actually reshape the social and economic hierarchy, and that will be bad for establishment
right.
Democrats.
And I want to relitigate the Philadelphia Democratic National Convention, when the Democratic Party really put their thumb on the scale to make sure Bernie Sanders did not get the nomination. And look at how different things would have been. Now, I'm sitting in this seat, so I must channel Teresa Bourgeois and say that
she was there just yesterday.
Okay, I feel
so
it.
So it's still, you'll still feel the vibe.
I feel it. So let's just say, of course, Democratic policy positions are substantially better for the public interest. But the way the Democratic Party is reacting to this moment in time is political malpractice. And, it's not across the board. There are exceptions. But why is it that Bernie Sanders, at age 82, mm-hmm. maybe, needs to barnstorm the country to go into key congressional districts to point out the obvious?
Well, he needs to, but also is resonating with the people.
Yes.
Hundreds of thousands of people are coming out to see him, to see AOC. And it's not like it's a message. Now, you could say, oh, there goes Bernie. He's out going to the country. And, you know, he's talking to a chicken dinner in Iowa. No, he's going to Las Vegas and bringing in 50,000 people.
Right.
I mean, it's not like you don't have the proof that this message is resonating. It was resonating in New York City. And you wonder at what point you get the tap on the shoulder of saying, oh, maybe we should do something about that.
But Aaron is right. There are billionaires funding the status quo.
And told Democrats adopt a populist strategy that redistributes wealth from the 1% to everybody else, they're going to lose. And they will lose those donors, but they will gain vote, but they will win at the polls.
I think it was just a high five at the studio.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say that every week now. Every time that I'm on, until Democrats adopt a populist economic message, affordable housing, universal health care, they will lose. Climate change.
I think what's interesting is even if Democrats adopted a populist platform and won and, you know, adopted legislation that the corporate entities opposed, the corporate entities would still donate because they still want leverage and support. By the people who are actually in office. So there's this sort of fear that they would lose support, but there's been a demonstration that major donors are willing to continue donating even if the elected is adopting legislation that they oppose. Just look at all the major donors contributing to Donald Trump right now who are actually losing money, tremendous amounts of money over his trade policies.
Yeah, I think, another great point.
I think you're absolutely right with one exception. Fossil fuel companies much prefer Republicans than Democrats. And remember, Trump had the fossil fuel executives come to Mar-a-Lago before the presidential race and literally said, give me $1 billion and I will do whatever you want me to do. And I think they gave him $500 million and he's doing everything that the fossil fuel industry wants to do. The fossil fuel industry is not as cozy with Democrats as they are with Republicans.
Peggy writes, don't you think that many voters are disappointed, despondent, disgusted, etc.? There are many who have stopped listening to the news and given up on government and who are thinking the system truly doesn't care about them. So why bother? What is the percentage of voters who have given up versus those who are out protesting and angry as hell, planning to be active?
Yeah, I mean, it's brutal reading the news every day. I used to get up in the morning, you know, hop out of bed and make organic coffee and read the news and start my day and life was good. And now I am practically weeping reading about how immigrants are being treated, reading about the attack on the EPA. But I think we just all need to be very good at compartmentalizing.
Yeah, I think compartmentalization is good. I mean, as being of Irish descent, most of my entertainment is derived in reading really depressing Irish novels and films and plays. So, you know, why should this be any different? Do I want to go into a closet and go into the fetal position with my blankie? Yes. And maybe I even do.
But, with wine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Irish whiskey. Oh, yeah. But still, you can't. I mean, I understand people who tell us. People say this to us all the time, meaning us being the radio station. Sometimes I have to turn it off because it's just too much. I get it. We understand. Absolutely. But when you want to check in and you want to know what's going on and when you want to know what's there, it's essential to find it out because it's just coming in such a torrent that you really can't afford not to know what's happening.
I just want to pitch, I get the absolute exhaustion of the fire hose in the face every day, all day right now. And I feel it. I run a large nonprofit. There's constant risks to like everything that we do. And on the weekends, I've taken to hiding out in the woods, even more than the before times. I mean, you do have to separate yourself from this constant onslaught of like just negative, violent, traumatic, traumatizing news. Like I get that. You don't have to be the person at the front lines all the time. No one has to do that all the time. Everybody has a role to play in any kind of movement. If you can't be on the front lines and you also can't be a supporting actor, you can be a donor. Mm-hmm. You can support public radio. You can support the organizations
Beyond
that align with your beliefs.
Perhaps.
You can buy people's books. Congratulations, Judith, on your new book. And there are things we can do that like preserve our like mental health. And also contributes to like a global, like, you know, a bigger movement. And also we have to vote. Like we have to vote.
And you can do two things at one time. I mean, you can go spend, not even at one time, but you can go spend quality time with your 2-year-old pup and have good quality time. I mean, my dog, like that is my, you know, that's my security blanket. To have the dog next to me and just go through and then I don't think about anything else. And then, you know, you go out and you do other things.
Like get back in it.
And you get back into it.
It's important to remember that Donald Trump is an entertainer. Mm. He likes the spotlight and he does anything to be in the spotlight. It's okay to check out. And I do. I understand the larger contours about what's going on. When we need to discuss something in depth, I do a little bit more research than I would normally do. But he's an entertainer. He wants people to follow them.
It's the whole spectacle.
It's the spectacle. And by following them and getting caught in that vortex, you're playing into his hands and you'll become exhausted and defeated. It's okay to check out. We all understand what's happening. The important thing is to be actionable, and that's primarily to vote out Republicans in the midterms.
All right, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We have a great group going this morning. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Friday, end of the week. It's the 8th of August, 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. And Judith Henk is with us, former EPA regional administrator, professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics. Aaron Pacitti is with us, Siena College professor of economics. And Nick Rangel, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, a terrific panel. On a terrific day, and we welcome you and your letters, panel@wamc.org. I'm going to read more letters because people are...
They're good. They're good letters.
Because they're complaining to Aaron that I haven't read enough letters. Okay, here we go. Barry says, who cares if major donors would still donate? Make the donations illegal. Monies in sums outweighing most people's annual incomes is not an expression of free speech. It is a restriction of pluralism and debate. Want to get in on that one, Aaron?
Of course, that's correct. The Supreme Court's not going to overturn Citizens United, probably until there's a 6-3 liberal majority. So, sure, yes, that's 100% correct. This is what a plutocracy looks like. But it's not. But it's going to be here for another couple decades.
That's a good chant at a rally. This is what plutocracy looks like. Tell me what plutocracy looks like.
We go to Marion. That's a good letter. Marion says, the most maddening thing about top Dems not supporting Mamdani is what the alternative is. There's a Republican, a crooked mayor who is beholden to Trump, and a former governor who was pushed out for sexual harassment. Okay, so is Gillibrand all right with that when she torpedoed Al Franken for less? I don't think Mamdani is a shoo-in without full-throated party support, given the resources arrayed against him. If he loses, the Democrats will have hell to pay for with a Democratic sex offender in office and young people checking out again, not only in New York City, but across the nation.
Good letter. And I don't think Zoran Mamdani is a shoo-in at all. That you have these super PACs that are going to be spending unprecedented amounts of money. And I'm nervous to even say these words, but I have this real worry that Trump is going to convince Eric Adams to drop out. Because Trump and Adams have a relationship. You know, Trump administration dropped criminal charges against Adams. And then they're going to try to clear the field for the former governor who is a documented sexual predator, according to a New York State Attorney General's report.
So you clear the field, you give it to Cuomo, and this is a person who, let us make no mistake about it, was rejected by voters
in the primary.
In the primary.
Mm-hmm. And on his own, resigned his governorship. The voters didn't push him out. He resigned on his own.
So who do you think would win that?
I think if Adams drops out and massive spending from independent expenditure campaigns, I think Zoran Mamdani still has a shot, but I think it's going to be really tight.
Okay.
And then Cuomo would get it. Curtis Sliwa is an interesting candidate. The last time he ran, he got, I think, like 24% of the vote. And so I think a lot of Republicans will stick with Sliwa and not go with Cuomo because of past concerns about Cuomo. But it's not a settled field. And so it's very significant that you have the hierarchy of the Democratic Party right now not endorsing Mamdani. I think it's a huge mistake.
This is another take. I think it's clear that the majority of voters, Republican voters, don't care that much about sexual malfeasance, right? And so, like, that's not really a deterrent, whether it's for Cuomo or somebody else, right? And I do think that there could be people who, like, Republican voters who vote for Cuomo basically vote against the Democratic candidate,
exactly,
right? And so,
like,
you could see a lower turn, like a lower support for Curtis, higher support for Cuomo. That's more bipartisan and independent voters as like a protest vote against Mamdani.
Yeah.
I think it's super interesting.
I think it's still,
I don't know. Weird. There's a lot of weird stuff going on.
Yeah. If Eric Adams stays in the race, and his ego probably would require that.
Yes, absolutely.
then I think Zoran Mamdani has a very good chance of being the next mayor of New York City. But there will be weird backroom deals between now and Election Day. And Eric Adams is probably looking at his polls and knows he's not going to win. So he's probably thinking, what's my next job? Maybe I need an appointment by Trump to serve somewhere in the federal government.
They're boys now.
And this goes back to an earlier discussion about the fire hose of news. But currently, Adams is facing any criminal... Or that's been removed.
Oh, no, Trump removed it.
He removed
his
it.
Charges are dropped.
All of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, but people around him are...
Just had to check the box score.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But his top advisors are still facing...
Like his campaign manager, I think, was... Well, still facing charges.
I don't think she's the campaign manager. She was like the deputy mayor, and then also his fundraisers. They're still facing criminal charges.
Left his friends behind.
All right, let's go back to just a few letters. Thanks to Judith for bringing up the mayoral election in New York City. I cannot possibly agree more. I'm 72 and delaying a move to the Hudson Valley to cast my vote for Mamdani in November. He will make some terrible mistakes, I'm sure, but I'm done with the old white guys and find Mamdani's primary win to be a ray of sunshine in the perpetual toxic gloom of our national politics. And one more before we move on to other stuff. Well, here we go again. Another both sides do it proclamation on an NPR program without any discussion about a level of degree. Why is this so difficult for news media to counter? Yes, both parties have used gerrymandering to their advantage in different states, but to suggest that it is equal and that in this day and age is just factually incorrect. Why not say that when you are discussing both parties doing this, if one side is using gerrymandering and the other is not, there is an inherent, and the other party is not, pause, there is an inherent inequality. The problem is that there must be a federal requirement that specifically spells out how states fairly draw congressional districts. Without such a statute, there will not be true fairness in district drawing anywhere. And the point of Russell's note is that it's our fault.
Well, thank you for writing. You don't need a federal law to ensure fair and reasonable legal redistricting. States can do that with independent redistricting commissions that are based on math and looking at representation. It can be done.
David, go ahead.
I would just note that in New York, there was an effort to redraw the maps in 2020, and those maps were twice thrown out by the courts because of alleged gerrymandering. And so there, I think while it is true Republican-leaning states have lower levels of good government oversight of the redistricting process because most of them don't have commissions, and many of the Democratic-led states do have commissions, which does, like in New York, they're bipartisan, there are appointments, there's a court oversight, and in New York, severely gerrymandered districts have a higher tendency or a higher likelihood of being struck down. One could argue that the effort had been made. Some people have argued that, like, if both parties had free rein, they might both arrive at a similarly high rate of gerrymandering without that oversight. I'm not making that argument. I'm just suggesting that we don't see that at the same rate as places like Texas because of these laws that are in place that Democratic-led legislatures adopted.
We could spend the rest of the show reading the letters that we have, but I do want to get to other topics. So thank you very much, and I'm sorry if we hurt your feelings, but we try to get to as many letters as we can. I think we have had a lot of the points that have been made expressed, so let's move on to other stuff, if you don't mind, as we try to get on a whole lot of topics in our next half hour. Let's go to solar energy grants. The EPA moves to cancel $7 billion, with a B, $7 billion in grants for solar energy. This is under the Biden administration. The EPA awarded all $7 billion that Congress had put forward. Now, if finalized, the move would escalate the Trump administration's efforts to claw back that money awarded under President Biden. The Environmental Protection Agency is drafting termination letters to the 60 state agencies, nonprofit groups, and Native American tribes that received the grants under the Solar for All program, with the goal of sending the letters by the end of this week, according to two people who spoke on the condition of anonymity. If finalized, the move would escalate the Trump administration's efforts to claw back billions of dollars in grants awarded under the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, President Biden's signature climate law, and it would be certain to draw legal challenges from the grant recipients, many of whom have pursued projects in Republican-led states. Judith.
So this makes absolutely no sense, which you can say that for most policies coming out of Lee Zeldin's EPA these days. And it will hurt Republican districts. I mean, the states that have the most wind, for instance, are Iowa and Texas. But here we have a program targeting low-income and moderate-income consumers. It would save people money on their monthly utility bill, so speaking to affordability. And it would also reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. So what does the Trump administration do? They attempt to cancel this. I think the clawback won't survive legal challenge, but you never know, especially if it goes to the Supreme Court. And some of this money, for instance, was going to Indian nations, where out west, a lot of the residents don't have electricity at all. So this is not about suburbanites putting solar panels on their roof and running the meter backwards, which every suburbanite should do. This is also about, you know, basic access to electricity in areas of the country that don't have it. Trump has said he wants, you know, his first day in office, he declared an energy emergency. And they use the phrase, and it's kind of jarring when you hear it a lot, energy dominance. So what does that mean? Certainly it doesn't mean solar and wind and geothermal, but they want to export large amounts of liquefied natural gas and coal to other countries. That's their definition of energy dominance. It's not energy independence. And, you know, this is clawing back the solar money is really going to hurt individual people. It's going to make the climate crisis worse. And when I refer to, you know, the difficulty of this moment we are in politically, the climate crisis is here. It's not something in the future. Just go outside and breathe in the Canadian wildfire smoke. Look at the terrible floods in Texas. This year will likely be the hottest year on record, and we're gonna say that over and over again. I was at a medical appointment recently, and the doctor said, "You know, it's going to be hotter next week." And I said, "It's going to be hotter the rest of our life." And the health and economic implications are huge. Now, do not despair. People are organizing around this issue. And I want to point out that Bill McKibben's group, Third Act, has called for a national day of action to promote solar. And so Sunday is coming on Sunday, September 21st. And the very capable Michael Richardson with Third Act Upstate New York and his colleagues are organizing an event in Albany at the Egg on Sunday, September 21st. There are events all over the region to promote solar. So this is really well timed. So go to thirdact.org and see where you can learn about solar energy in your community.
Just two quick things. One, Bill, mutual friend, good friend, great guy, has a new book out called Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. It comes out on August 19th, just in time for the events that you were talking about. He'll be doing the circuit. He'll be on our show, I think, a week later. And then we have an event at Skidmore College scheduled for October. So a lot going on in regards to that book.
Great. It's every Bill McKibben book is wonderful. And I think reading this report on federal funding not only being reduced, but clawed back on solar, the Bill McKibben book tour, the Third Act Sunday events are more urgent than ever before.
Excellent. Let's see. We have a few moments. Let's go into one more topic before we go over to the unless there's anybody who wanted to say anything about what.
Well, I just wanted to like highlight, too, what's interesting about cutting funding for renewable and natural resources in the U.S. Trump is also pressuring foreign countries to purchase more fossil fuels and natural gas from us. So we're depleting the not renewable resources that we have from both directions. We're forcing mm-hmm. higher consumption within the United States and also forcing foreign countries to purchase right. more from us. It just like the inevitable is huge increases in cost and a lack of alternative for the majority of people in the U.S. in like not that long a timeline.
It's the return on investment on the Mar-a-Lago visit right. of give me $1 billion in campaign contributions. And what I've been thinking about lately is how the entire environmental condition of the world is being sacrificed So less than 10 fossil fuel companies can continue to make money. That's kind of an astonishing thing in the history of the world.
But even there, they were never not going to continue to make money. Like, we weren't not using that not renewable resource. We were depleting it. Like, and we are depleting it. Like, there is no universe with those 10 companies don't continue to make tremendous profits, well, even if we were expanding solar.
Yes and no, because companies like Exxon were actually losing money because people were shifting to renewable energy, electric vehicles. And that's why plastic is the big investment at Exxon, because they see in the United States, at least, more commitment and use of renewable energy resources.
But as a clarification, they weren't losing money. They were just not earning as big a profits. They were having slightly smaller, tremendous mm-hmm. profits. They were still making a lot of money,
right.
Like billions of dollars.
Like the reduction
was like, oh, that's a blip. I guess that's like a few million dollars less
right.
than
right.
normal. But they aren't they're not losing money.
At this point, renewable energy is on par or cheaper than fossil fuels.
Yeah, cheaper.
So this is transactional politics that has nothing to do with the making consumers better off, making the economy more efficient, to say nothing about the climate that Judith addressed. We're just taking a step backwards here and saying, well, the fossil fuel industry gave us all this money, so their investment in the Trump administration paid off. So while the U.S. is doing this, the scale of investment that China in particular is putting into electric vehicle production, mm-hmm. The next
panels.
Generation of solar panels.
Yep. Battery storage.
If people think that the China 1.0 shock that happened when they entered the global stage in 2000 up until now, that, displaced a lot of manufacturing workers and kind of was one of the most rapid economic development strategies in world history, the China 2.0 economic revolution is going to dwarf what has happened, because it's going to be long-term. It's investment in strategic industries, whereas China 1.0 just took advantage of low-cost labor.
Right, right. The writer David Wallace Wells, who just had a great piece on plastics in the New York Times on Sunday.
Yeah, it was a great piece.
Yeah. And
great graphic, too, by the way.
Yeah, really good. I met him at New York Writers Institute last year. He's a brilliant environmental writer. He made the point, and I kind of disputed it at the time, that, yeah, these Trump policies are terrible, but it's not going to affect what China and India do. And that's absolutely correct, although it will affect the ability to import these products because of tariffs.
I just want to mention that the Bill McKibben event that I was talking about taking place in Saratoga on the Skidmore College campus is Wednesday, October 22nd. It's at 6 o'clock. It's in the Gannett Auditorium at Palo Mountain Hall. And you can find out more information by going to northshire.com. You do need to get tickets for that event.
Ooh, hurry up. That's going to sell out.
It will. So that's why we're talking about it now. But October 22nd, 6 o'clock at Palo Mountain Hall on the college campus of Skidmore.
A hot ticket
indeed. In so many ways. We're gonna take a break.
You got it.
Yeah, I did. It's coming down Fifth Avenue. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll finish up the show. Lots more to talk about. We'll dabble in some global trade talk when we return, and much, much more right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I felt bad the last couple of weeks because every time we get to Aaron, we have like there's all these related topics, and it's like in a big basket filled with stuff. And as much as I try to extricate one thing over the other, it's just like you just take this big ball of mush and hand it over to him and say, make something with that. Yeah. But let's stay somewhat focused, and we'll stay with trade. We'll stay with global trade. We'll stay with what's happening in Brazil. and with India and what this means for us all.
So last week, with Mark Whitman and Teresa Bourgeois, we spent a lot of time talking about the details of, okay, the 90-day deadline after Liberation Day is up, talking in excruciating detail, which was important to understanding what's about to happen. But when I emailed Joe yesterday, I promised that I'm not going to get into the weeds. I want to just take a higher-level approach because
this week, without the excruciation.
And, you know, honestly, the real reason for that is I'm confused by all of this.
Well, we were talking about that last week, too. Like, how do you not be confused?
So a couple of major points to stress that this is just part of the Trump playbook where it's an us versus them. Either we win or we lose. So if we run a trade deficit, then they, meaning anybody but the United States, is winning and we're losing. So the new tariffs are in place. They went into effect at 12:01 Thursday morning. They vary by country. This is the biggest trade shock in the last century in the United States in terms of tariffs, which are just a tax on imported goods. And what's going to happen, and I stressed this last week, and I will stress it every time we talk about trade, is that the tariffs are estimated to cost the average household an extra $3,000 per year in higher costs. But that doesn't include the stuff that people stop buying because it's just too expensive.
Right.
So it's actually an understatement in terms of what the effect it's going to have on people's standard of living. It's going to raise prices. Many economists forecast, 4-ish% inflation by the end of 2025. So people are going to feel the hit. And I was alluding to this earlier when Nick was talking about, mobilizing for the 26 midterms. And to Trump, this is a dominance display. He's strutting around talking about all these deals he's secured with the EU and Japan. These are not deals. There is nothing legal or enforceable about what he is doing. What's happening is that other countries appear to be bowing down to Trump. He enjoys the flattery, so he gives them preferential treatment in terms of tariffs. But so he can claim victory, and the trade negotiators for Japan and the EU and these other countries are not dumb. They know exactly how to play Trump to get the outcome they want. But the other point I want to stress, the bigger picture issue here, is something that Judith and I were both alluding to towards the end of the solar discussion. The stated goal of the Trump administration's policies is to reshape global trading relations. And he's going to accomplish that. But he's not going to accomplish that with the outcome that's going to make the U.S. a stronger global superpower. What's going to happen, and you're already starting to see this, is that Brazil, India, China, the European Union, Canada, all of the world's major economies are going to, one, lose trust in the U.S. as a reliable trading partner because, hey, tomorrow morning there's no tariffs, and then the morning after they're 25%. And what it's going to do is shift the balance of power away from the United States and towards other countries as they start to rethink trade relationships. And that's ultimately going to be to the detriment of U.S. manufacturing because the U.S. is now viewed as an unreliable trading partner. So this is not going to be good for individuals. This is not going to be good for the economy. And this is not going to be good for U.S. foreign policy, which is something that's overlooked. We look like, I think a banana republic is too loose a term at this point. We're like a clown republic of just, policy changes by the day, and it's only affecting a $30 trillion economy. So, who really cares what's going to happen? This is going to have impacts. It's going to hit people in the pocketbook, and it's not going to happen all at once. It's going to be a slow boil, but between now and the end of this year, and then particularly in 26, people are going to feel this. And it's really going to reshape and damage the United States' international reputation as a reliable trading partner and ultimately as a reliable ally. So he's walking around patting himself on the back for all of these deals, And yet here we all are bearing the cost of, you know, China, or I'm sorry, Japan and the EU stroking his ego.
So much for Liberation Day.
Yeah. Liberation from what? Prosperity?
I mean, I think what when you piece together the reconciliation bill, which provides these like tremendous tax cuts to wealthy people, but also adds trillions to the U.S. deficit, you start to see this urgency to raise those dollars somewhere else. And those dollars are coming in as tariffs instead of so we're spreading out the cost of the reconciliation bill to consumers, right? Mm-hmm. And you're doing it in a way that avoids the word tax, but it is a tax. And you're doing it in a way that goes through producers and sellers instead of through government collection services, mm-hmm. right? Like through the tax department or finance department. And so the impact of that is it disproportionately carried by low and middle income households because they have fewer choices in what they can purchase and fewer like less ability to change consumer habits than higher income populations. And so basically low and middle income people are paying the price and the cost of the reconciliation bill through tariffs, and wealthy families are both receiving the benefit of lower taxes and maintain the benefit of consumer choice in purchasing.
It's a very definition of regressive.
Yeah. Reverse Robin Hood.
Yeah. And the tariff is a tax, mm-hmm. and the federal government is already really dependent on that new revenue. So we're all paying more for bananas and coffee, and Jeff Bezos can get another yacht.
Meanwhile, the benefit that the government is providing to low and middle income households through SNAP. Social networks, yep. SNAP, Medicaid, those are all being cut as well. So it is the low and middle income households that are taking it in both directions. Cuts to benefits, fewer benefits in the tax relief under the bill, and greater cost out of pocket. And now less access to solar and cheaper renewable energy sources.
Yeah, that EPA program targeted low-income consumers and moderate-income consumers.
I hate to say this, but, you know, like, for many people, the climate's invisible, right? It's not a pressing concern that affects their day-to-day life. And I'm putting myself in somebody else's shoes saying this.
Unless you're breathing in the wildfires.
Well, unless, you know, droughts and floods affect mm-hmm. the price of fresh fruits and vegetables.
Or kills you.
It's these, the regressive impacts that Nick and Judith were both talking about, that's the stuff that that's going to hit people hard and will be impossible to ignore. And this is why I think the Trump administration's starting to panic with the redistricting,
mm-hmm. yes.
with trying to install a lapdog, and as the chair of the Federal Reserve. He understands this is going to be economically damaging for the bulk of the population. And since it's unpopular, you know, you have to preserve your power somehow. So this has the potential. The silver lining to this is, it does need to get worse before it gets better. And low and middle income people, a large part of Trump's base, are the ones who are going to feel the pinch. And that might tilt the scales to Democrats gaining at least the House in 2026.
Yeah. And remember, the dominant political issue during the presidential race was the price of eggs.
Yeah, right.
Remember the price of eggs? That was the issue.
Yeah. Which had very little to do with economics. It was,
marketing.
Bird flu and inflation.
Well, and even with the price of eggs, right? We cut all the funding that would have found solutions, vaccinations, medications to like reduce the spread of bird flu. And now there's an outbreak among cows, right? Isn't there a beef shortage? I'm a vegetarian. I stopped following that story, but I think there's like a beef problem. And we've cut all the funding to like address that problem as well.
Well, there's no one in the White House who has the position of dealing with any kind of biological outbreak. And bird flu continues to be a pretty serious problem.
With that, we must end. Our time has come, and I appreciate all of you sharing your expertise and for such a vibrant and civilized conversation. You're all wonderful. I hope you have a beautiful weekend. Nick Rangel, Aaron Pasitti, Judith Enk, go forth, do good work, and we'll get back here and talk about it very soon. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.